You're listening to local and regional news on KMUN. I'm Ava Berardi.
And I'm Katie Frankowitz. A 22-bed shelter in downtown Astoria has announced its closing for now. The announcement follows reductions in state funding for emergency shelter operations in Clatsop County. The organization behind the shelter, Lifeboat Services, had criticized the county's approach to how the state money was allocated across different service providers. At a recent meeting, the county adjusted how it was distributing the money. But in order for Lifeboat Services to sign on and receive the money, the organization needed to commit to offering the same level of services, something Executive Director Ozark Orok told KMUN would be impossible given the still significantly lower amount Lifeboat was set to receive. The closure of the shelter comes as an amended camping ordinance went into effect in Astoria. Since July 15th, Astoria police have been actively enforcing the city's new camping ordinance with homeless campers. City officials say the focus is on moving people towards resources, including shelter options. Orok says Lifeboat had offered the lowest barrier nightly shelter in the county. County officials told KMUN more beds have been developed at the county-run Columbia Inn shelter, also in Astoria. I'm Katie Frankowitz reporting.
Much of Central Oregon is under red flag warning through Wednesday due to extreme wildfire weather. The region is expected to get another round of thunderstorms on top of hot, dry weather. More than 375,000 acres are burning across the state, mostly in central and north central Oregon. Carol Connolly is a spokesperson for the Northwest Interagency Coordination Center in Portland. She advised Oregonians to be extra careful this week.
Any new human-caused fire will take critical resources away from those fires. So, you know, we need to do our part and be very vigilant when it comes to adhering to the local restrictions.
More than 1,000 Oregonians have had to evacuate their homes due to wildfires this week. The Trump administration is ratcheting up its presence on election officials in states like Oregon. In a press conference Monday, Secretary of State Tobias Reid accused the federal government of sowing distrust in elections ahead of the midterms. OPB's Bryce Dole reports.
The Trump administration has gone to court and even threatened to arrest election leaders in states like Oregon. Those actions came before President Trump's primetime address from the White House last week, during which he continued to push unsubstantiated claims of widespread voter fraud. Reid says the president and his allies are illegally trying to suppress votes ahead of what's expected to be a tough midterm. He says Trump's actions show the extent to which he and his allies are trying to avoid accountability from voters.
Taken together, they paint a clear picture. This is not about improving elections. It's about putting political pressure on the people responsible for administering them.
Reid says Oregon's elections are secure and safe, and that instances of voter fraud are rare. I'm Bryce Dole, reporting.
You're listening to local and regional news on KMUN. Now moving to news from Washington. A draft water supply forecast predicts that in the future, the Columbia Basin will have less water available in the summer and early fall. NWPB's senior environmental correspondent Courtney Flatt explains.
Every 5 years, Washington's Department of Ecology must forecast changes in water needs and supplies, and what that could mean for people and wildlife. By looking 20 years ahead, they hope to help communities plan for long-term water needs. Sasha McLarty is a professor at Washington State University. She led the research team. She says there are things that can be done to help groundwater, like having some people use surface water instead, but
without those actions, groundwater levels are, on the whole, going down across eastern Washington.
The forecast also predicts multi-year droughts could get worse as the climate continues to change. Public comments on the draft can be submitted through the end of the month. I'm Courtney Flatt.
Election officials around the region are installing new ballot drop boxes ahead of the primary on August 4th. KUOW's Scott Greenstone has more on why.
Election officials in Snohomish, King, and Pierce counties have installed 15 new ballot drop boxes since May. Though the drop boxes are an alternative to voting by mail, officials say they do not anticipate any issues with the post office delivering ballots. The president has used USPS to push for vote-by-mail regulations. Those are tied up in court. any changes to Postal Service rules can't take effect before November, meaning Washington's primary will not be affected. That's according to a spokesperson for Washington's Secretary of State. In King County, election officials hope to install 9 more drop boxes before November, bringing the countywide total to 100. Right now, King County Elections estimates only 3% of voters live more than 3 miles away from a drop box. I'm Scott Greenstone in Seattle.
A proposal before Seattle City Council would strip citizens' rights to appeal environmental findings in major land use and zoning changes before they become law. The legislation aims to protect the city's controversial comprehensive plan. More from KNKX environment reporter Bellamy Palethorpe.
The proposal comes in response to the success of a Seattle Symphony bass player who challenged the city's comp plan, saying its environmental impact statement is insufficient. The 20-year plan codifies zoning changes that will guide Seattle's growth. Seattle wants to quickly build a lot of new housing. The city's Land Use and Sustainability Committee passed the legislation last week. Councilmember Eddie Lynn sponsored it. In his newsletter, he wrote that too often a small handful of homeowners and business interests weaponize appeals under the State Environmental Protection Act. However, the Seattle Times reports that council staff determined there were only 28 such environmental appeals to the Seattle Hearing Examiner over the past 10 years. I'm Bellamy Palethorpe reporting.
The race for Washington State's 3rd congressional district will be crucial for determining the balance of power in Congress. 9 candidates are running in the state's August primary, but only 2 will emerge from that race to compete in November. OPB's Eric Newman reports.
This year, because of a wave of redistricting across the country, there are fewer truly competitive seats in Congress. One exception is the seat held by Democratic Representative Marie Glusenkamp-Perez in Southwest Washington. She first won in a close election in 2022. That's in a district where many counties went for President Donald Trump in the last general election.
We're still a very independent-minded people in Southwest Washington.
The 2-term Democrat is facing her most competitive and well-funded challenge from John Braun, the leading state senator in Washington's Republican Party. When Braun talks about the people he wants to represent in Congress, he sounds a lot like Glusenkamp-Perez.
The great thing about the 3rd District is it's a very independent district.
Candidates will need to appeal to independents to win this coveted swing district. Justin Matheson is the Northwest director for the Republican consulting firm Axiom Strategies.
Essentially, the 3rd district is nationwide is in the top 5, if not, I would say, in the top 3 targets in the country.
Dean Nielsen, a Democratic strategist with CN4 Partners in Seattle, says this year's election looks good for his party, but it's too early for any candidate to get comfortable.
I don't think this race is in the bag, but I also tell my clients there's 2 kinds of politicians. There's paranoid and former.
President Trump endorsed Braun in April. Braun says he supports the administration's current strategy in the Iran war, and on health care, he thinks they have the right approach to making cuts to the Medicaid program.
I support President Trump. I don't agree with him on everything. I don't think any of us agree with anybody all the time.
For example, Braun says he disagrees with the president when it comes to the use of tariffs. If elected, 2 of his pro-business priorities would be keeping the federal income tax rate low and promoting energy production from all types of sources.
Don't just talk about small businesses. How do you actually make it better for them? You make it by helping keep their costs low.
The hiss of power tools can be heard on the assembly room floor at Braun's family business in Centralia, Washington. On a recent day, he stood looking out as some of his 350 employees cut huge sheets of aluminum for the emergency vehicles they manufacture.
Washington has been most successful when we had a little more balanced government. It's certainly, no one would make the claim that it's all that balanced in recent years.
Braun's opponent, Marie Glusenkamp-Perez, owns a mom-and-pop car repair shop in Portland with her husband, though they live in Southwest Washington. She says her work in D.C. is about refocusing power on the lives of everyday people.
You know, I've been in Congress for 3.5 years now with a majority that often seems to think the only solution is to sort of burn it all down. And then that sort of backed some people on the left into this fierce defense of institutions. And I think you've got to figure out the middle ground there where it's like, no, institutions are never perfect.
She says her legislation is focused on the needs of her constituents, even if that means blurring party lines.
And I think representing a very red seat and a very blue state requires a level of candor and consideration about when the legislation isn't doing what people thought it was going to do.
One example is her recent bill aimed at protecting endangered salmon and steelhead in the Columbia River. It would allow Southwest Washington tribes to kill protected sea lions when they prey on the fish. That legislation got immediate support from the Trump administration. Glusenkamp Perez has been criticized by constituents for her support of Israel in its war with Hamas.
And it is in the interest of our country to have a liberal democracy in the Middle East, which it's strategic and durable, which is why I've opposed the war in Iran at 4 times now.
Voting turnout in primary elections is usually low, so who wins will probably be decided by how much each candidate can turn out their base. The election is expected to favor Democrats who are angry at Trump and Republicans, says Ben Gaskins, an associate professor of political science at Lewis and Clark College.
But sometimes it's just really simple. If the president's unpopular, if the Democratic generic ballot is in favor of the Democrats, nothing else may really matter.
Ballots have already been mailed out. They have to be postmarked by August 4th to be counted. I'm Eric Newman reporting.
Temperatures are climbing to near highs in the Puget Sound region this week, and a new law aims to make it easier to install portable ACs. State government reporter Sarah Mises-Tan has more.
The law helps make air conditioning a tenant's right. State Senator Vandana Slatter co-sponsored the measure. She says landlords used to be allowed to prevent AC installation.
So if you had a landlord that allowed it, that would be fine. But if you didn't, there was no way that you could put in a portable AC unit.
The law went into effect last month, but there are still some exceptions. Landlords can deny AC units in a lease. There are also restrictions around the type of unit that can be installed. Indoor cooling used to be a luxury in the Pacific Northwest, but a change in climate has made it more necessary. Over half of homes in King, Pierce, and Snohomish counties now have AC. In Olympia, I'm Sarah Mises-Tan.
Budget cuts have sharply reduced the Pentagon's efforts to find the remains of thousands of troops still missing from long-ago wars. And the impact is hitting one group of families especially hard. Jay Price reports for the American Homefront Project.
Raymond Echeverria Jr. of Roxborough, North Carolina, was 4 years old in 1966 when his father was reported missing. Raymond Sr., a Fort Bragg Green Beret, was part of a small reconnaissance team that had come under heavy fire in Laos. Family members hold out hope his remains can be recovered, but it gets harder as the Vietnam War slips further into history.
Some of the veterans that were there are dying off. You've got issues with bodies being there for 50, 60 years. You've got acidity issues in the soil. Time is passing, and they don't seem to be getting any closer to finding answers for a lot of Southeast Asia families.
The U.S. government's efforts to bring MIAs home sprang from a grassroots movement in the 1960s. More than 3,800 troops have been recovered, about 1,000 of those from the Vietnam War. But federal budget cuts this year would slash by more than two-thirds the number of recovery missions in Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia. That's according to the Pentagon Office responsible for the work, the Defense POW MIA Accounting Agency, or DPAA. Many of the more than 1,500 still missing from the Vietnam War are considered unrecoverable for various reasons, but others, like Echeverria's father, vanished under circumstances that make finding them more likely.
They know where the helicopter landed. They have done interviews with various, I call them NVA soldiers. They identified certain areas where they saw American bodies, so they've got a pretty good idea where they can go and excavate and look for them.
The DPAA says the budget cuts are part of Pentagon-wide reductions, and the effects were worsened by last year's government shutdown and fuel shortages in Southeast Asia tied to the war in Iran. This summer, the agency was placed under the Defense Department's Undersecretary for Personnel and Readiness, Anthony Tata. At a recent meeting, he told Vietnam MIA family members he'll lobby Congress and DOD leaders to get the funding restored.
I'm fully committed to increasing the budget for DPAA because it's a direct correlation for how many teams we can deploy into the field and how much research we can do and how many remains that we can process.
Senator Deb Fischer, a Nebraska Republican, also has introduced a bill to restore $40 million in funding, but its chances of passing are unclear. Ann Mills Griffiths, whose brother, James Mills, went missing in 1966 when his plane went down off the Vietnamese coast, was a longtime leader of the National League of POW/MIA Families. A skilled political operator who was close to President Ronald Reagan, she has fought for decades to get more funding for what became the DPAA, but she's long said the agency isn't prioritizing Vietnam cases as much as it should.
It's not at all satisfactory, especially with how hard we've worked and defended and fought for their assets and resources and priorities.
Even before the budget cuts, Vietnam War identifications were a fraction of those completed by the DPAA. The bulk of the agency's recoveries have come from World War II and the Korean War, where missing troops were more numerous and are often easier to find in places like POW cemeteries. But Raymond Echeverria Jr. says Vietnam War recoveries should be prioritized because family members who knew missing troops, like his father, are more likely to be alive.
Our prayer is that we're able to bring them home while we're still here before it goes to the next generation.
So far this year, out of more than 170 service members identified, just one was from the Vietnam War. I'm Jay Price reporting.
This story was produced by the American Homefront Project, a public media collaboration that reports on American military life and veterans. Local and regional news is brought to you by our news partners and by the KMUN News Team. For more local and regional news, go to kmun.org/news. American Democracy Minute is up next. You're listening to KMUN.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. President Trump's July 16th speech included elements of an activist-proposed national emergency executive order, which surfaced in March. New reporting suggests election denier groups were briefed by the White House before the speech. ProPublica reported in March about a D.C. meeting which convened 2020 activists to strategize about actions in the 2026 midterms. Allegedly discussed was a 17-page activist-proposed executive order suggesting that evidence of foreign interference could be used as a pretext to declare a national emergency and federalize U.S. election administration. The proposed order states, there is now clear and compelling evidence from court cases and forensic analysis that these threats have not been mitigated, but instead have intensified, unquote. It goes on to cite debunked 2020 conspiracy theories involving ballot tabulators compromised by foreign actors and fraudulent voting by domestic accomplices, a striking similarity to elements of the president's speech. MS Now reported July 16th that activist Cleta Mitchell facilitated a White House briefing for election integrity groups prior to Trump's speech. Contents of the briefing were not disclosed. Election law scholars say that such an order would be unconstitutional under the Elections Clause, even in an emergency. We've linked the activist proposal at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org.
You're listening to KMUN.